Welcome back, loyal listeners, of which there are a few now. We are seeing the stats and they're starting to incline, which is really, really good. I'm like to see that increase in people tuning in. We are, of course, Lifetime Cinema Club. I'm your host, Ryan, and I am joined once again by my co-host, Holsch. How are you, mate?
Really good, mate. Sunday, beautiful weather here, and about to talk about something that's not as beautiful as this weather.
Yeah, beautiful weather and ultra-depressing movie today, but still a brilliant film. Tonight, we arrive on the podium for 1980, so this is episode 8, but because we are counting down the top 10 films of each year, we are at number 3 for the year 1980. Listeners would have heard us last week discussing Kagemusha, Akira Kurosawa's absolute classic. But tonight, we are talking about something that is a difficult watch. I'm sure upon your first watch of this, Holsch, you were thinking, why the hell did you make me sit through that?
In lead up, all I had up my sleeve was a photo of Dennis Hopper and Linda Manns sitting in his car, and he's got his arm around her and she's sort of just tucked in there, and, you know, looked like a really moving, tight-knit dad and daughter. And then the other tip was that you said it was really depressing. So in my eyes, I thought, oh yeah, this is going to be something about the daughter, and, you know, eventually, you know, does something to herself, and the dad's, you know, super depressed because he's so caring and loves his daughter so much. But I will tell you right now, without going into it, this movie took me by the biggest surprise of any of your selections so far. Just absolutely hit me in the guts and still does. Like, I think about this movie every day, but mate, let it out.
Yeah, so we are at number 3 for 1980, and like you just discussed, mate, a real gut-wrenching film, but still a brilliant film. Number 3 is Out of the Blue, directed by Dennis Hopper.
Welcome to Lifetime Cinema Club.
Okay, so Out of the Blue, the number 3 spot for our 1980 countdown. And as usual, I will go through the crew, cast and crew, and I will also now read out what Letterboxd has as a plot summary. A young girl whose father is an ex-convict and whose mother is a junkie finds it difficult to conform and tries to find comfort in a quirky combination of Elvis and the punk scene. Never has a paragraph been so misleading, as far as I'm concerned.
And every other Letterboxd spiel that you've rolled off for these movies have been nigh on, like spot on. But I'll tell you what, this one's a little bit more vague.
Oh, this is skew-if. This is really doesn't really know what you're getting into. Definitely the use of quirky. Yeah, don't know about that. This is a film that is nihilistic to its core. And as I said, directed by Dennis Hopper. Dennis Hopper returned to the director's chair for this film after the great success of Easy Rider in the late 60s, which was really the jump-off point and the kicking off of a lot of the New Age Hollywood and counterculture type of filmmaking and music, that entire scene, punk rock scene, kind of coming out of the free love hippie scene, really kicked off with Easy Rider. Post Easy Rider, he was thrown a lot of money by the standards in the early 70s to make a movie which he called The Last Movie. And I swear, out of the millions of dollars he got thrown, I think about 75% of that went up his nose or into his veins through the making of that film. You must see The Last Movie if you have not seen it. I know you recently watched it, Holsch. A confusing mess of a film, yeah. But just it's got to be seen to be believed.
Both those movies, Easy Rider and and the last movie I watched for the first time this week. And to be honest, they're both sort of very meandering plots. I still, to this point, for both of them, I'm not sure exactly what it's meant to be telling its viewers. It's very much all over the shop with Dennis Hopper's direction. And that's why this movie in particular, actually, I think this is his masterpiece that you're about to unfold here. And he seems to really pinpoint what he's trying to say more in this film. But yeah, those two movies, both still incredible visuals in both of them, but yep, just all over the shop.
Yeah, I won't say I'm an Easy Rider denier. I respect it. It's one of these films, again, that I respect more than I love. I've never been a huge Easy Rider fan. I remember when I first started to become, I hate saying this, but a cinephile, I guess, or just an absolute movie fanatic, you almost had to watch Easy Rider as it's like a tipping off point, right? It was like Easy Rider was lumped in with things like Taxi Driver, that you just had to watch. I never really warmed to it, if I'm being completely honest. If anything, I probably do enjoy the last movie more because I am partial to an absolute clusterfuck of a film. I like movies where the artistic vision of the director just goes apeshit, where they swing for the fences and they might not connect, but there's enough weird, interesting shit on the screen that just keeps my attention, even though it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. There's been a few films of those, especially recently. There's a Richard Kelly, who directed Donnie Darko, he followed up Donnie Darko with a film called Southland Tales, which I guess you could call the last movie of the 2000s. Just really unfocused, heaps of different plot strands and themes going in all directions that I sometimes really enjoy that. So if I was to rank do my Dennis Hopper rankings of those three films, Easy Rider, Out of the Blue, and Last Movie, I'd probably have Easy Rider last out of those three, even though it's probably, well, not even probably, the most well-known and well-regarded of the three.
I thought Fonda wasn't all that riveting as a lead act. I think Hopper was the better actor in that film as well.
He steals the show. He definitely steals the show. Oh, I'm probably going to have to hand in my my cinephile license after saying this, but I'm not a massive Peter Fonda fan. I never seem to really jive with him. There's one film, it's a Western, I'm going to cheat, The Hired Hand, early 70s Western, came out the same year as the last movie. The Hired Hand, that's a really great revisionist Western from the early 70s that Peter Fonda is in. But besides that, I've never really taken to him. I've always had always found him kind of cold. And you're right, Dennis Hopper steals that. Dennis Hopper, to be honest, steals nearly every movie he's in. He's just such a psycho. He's a freak. I mean, you've seen Speed.
I have, yeah. He's about the only... I am not a Speed fan. But
you're a speedhead.
No, I think Sandra Bullock is one actress I just have never been able to take hold of. And even in that movie, I just don't rate her. But Hopper is, once again, like we just said then, he does steal the show. He's the highlight of that movie as well.
Absolutely, steals the show on that. And going back to Out of the Blue, Out of the Blue always feels like to me, and I'm not the first person to think this, fucking nowhere near the first person. You just scroll through Letterboxd and see 1,000 people saying the same thing. But Out of the Blue always felt like to me as an indictment or a criticism or the death note to that counterculture scene that he was highlighting and kicked off an Easy Rider. This no fucks given kind of culture. Well, there are repercussions to that. And what we see 11 years down the line from Easy Rider to Out of the Blue is, it's almost like, I guess, a spiritual sequel or successor to Easy Rider. When I talk of Out of the Blue, obviously, where Hopper is the old burnout bikey 10 or 11 years down the line, and he's got a young family now, and he's just a fuck up in all facets of life, but just unrepentant about it as well, does not care about anyone or anything around him. It's just on a death drive. And that's what Out of the Blue is. And look, it is, again, like we said, it's quite a confronting watch, especially later in the film when more and more things are unveiled about what goes on. And we'll touch on those very touchy and icky subjects down the line. But this film is something that, even though it's an uncomfortable thing to recommend to people, I think this film is vital. And if I ever go ahead and make a top 100 or whatever all-time list, which I've gone and made and deleted 1,000 times, this has got to have a place in it somewhere. I just think it is an absolute masterpiece. Now, along with Dennis Hopper being the director and one of the leads in this film, the film actually belongs to Linda Marnes. She is an incredible actress and an actress that, like I say, quit at the height of her powers. Linda was 19 was she about 18 during filming of this?
18.
She's quite diminutive, quite small, so it looks very young, looks a lot younger than 18, and she's playing a 14-year-old, I believe, in this film. An incredible performance, and she, prior to this, was also one of the stars, and I think she did a lot of the voiceover work in the Terrence Malick film from 78, Days of Heaven, which I've said this about Kajamusha and a few other films, but Days of Heaven is one of the most beautiful films ever shot.
I only watched it for the first time this week as well, and it blew me away. It just kept my attraction 100% just purely for the visuals, and the story was tremendous too. But yeah, it's a must watch.
I remember you were raving. There was quite a few text messages getting thrown backwards and forwards to each other this week. You're like, holy fuck, Days of Heaven. But Linda Marnes was in that as well. And then towards the middle of the 80s, she just kind of disappeared. And I only just realized, but I was going through doing a little bit of Linda Marnes research, Holsh, and usually that is our research guru on this podcast. But I found an obituary about Linda Marnes. Well, she passed away about 4 years ago. Was that correct?
Mate, I'm actually, out of all my research, I have not looked into her passing. So this one's on you.
Yeah, I believe she passed away, I think it was 2020 or 2021, and she would have been in her late 50s or early 60s at the time. Sorry, I don't have the precise numbers, but she passed away from cancer. She's been a fascinating figure. So she starred in basically what you would call a critical canon classic in Days of Heaven. There's not a critic worth their salt out there that has panned that movie. That just got glowing praise from the get-go and continues to get praise, and as it should. Out of the Blue, obviously a lot more confronting, and has found an audience recently. Chloe Sevigny and a few other modern actresses have championed the film and led to its restoration a few years ago. To begin a career, back-to-back performances in Days of Heaven and Out of Blue would have suggested that Linda would have gone on to an incredible career, but instead she just literally fell off the face of the earth. And people were like, what's going on? Where has this girl gone? In her own words, she basically could see a lot of other people at the same time in Hollywood getting roles that she thought she should have and could have got. And instead of getting down about a few of those misses, she just thought, you know what, I'm going to retreat and just live a normal life. I believe she got married and had a few children, I think 2 or 3 children, and literally just disappeared off the Hollywood scene for quite some time. There are rumors getting around that she, much like her character in Out of the Blue, faced mistreatment or some form of abuse early in her career, which also prompted her disappearance. But she, for such an incredible announcement of a career, to jump in and do these two films, to just disappear was quite incredible. She basically said, I think the quote was, there's a whole bunch of new actors out there and I was kind of getting lost in the shuffle. So what I said was, screw it. I'm going to lay back. I had 3 kids and now I enjoy just staying home and cooking soup. So basically, she just disappeared. A little bit of pop trivia. She married a guy called Bobby Guthrie. Now, you ready for some really cool pop quiz here, Holsh?
Yeah.
Bobby Guthrie was a camera operator on one of Michael Jackson's early 80s classic film clips. Like, I don't know which one. This was when Michael Jackson's hair caught on fire. Do you remember that?
No.
Probably had too much fucking product in it, I'd say. But yeah, one of these, I don't know if it was Thriller or what film clip it was, but his hair caught on fire quite severely, and then his clothes caught on fire, and he suffered quite serious burns. And it was Bobby Guthrie who came to his rescue. It was either a film clip or a commercial. I can't remember now. It was one of the two. But that's who she married. A guy called Bobby Guthrie, who saved Michael Jackson from burning to death.
There you go. Good work, Bobby.
Yeah, good on you, Bobby. So that's Linda Marnes. She was an incredible actress, and it's such a shame we didn't see her in more films. She was just incredible. As far as the other crew are concerned, We've got Sharon Farrell playing Kathy, who is Linda Marnes, or CB. CB is the name of the character that Linda Marnes is playing. Sharon Farrell plays her mother, who herself is a junkie and does put herself and her daughter in dangerous situations all of the time. And then we've got Don Gordon playing one of the all-time pieces of shit ever put to film, besides Dennis Hopper in this film, and his name is Charlie, an absolute piece of shit. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, mate, I just loathe him so badly. And he's also in the last movie, and when Hopper, because Hopper wasn't the director on this film originally, and he was only brought into the film to be an actor, and then 2 weeks in, they fired the old director. I think his name is Leonard Yakir or something like that. And then Hopper came in, and the one actor that he basically dragged in as a new cast member for the film was Don. So he's obviously close-knit with him from the last movie and probably some cocaine nights and stuff, and then said, I got to get this bloke in for the out of the blue. And he's perfect for the role, let's face it.
Oh, just makes my skin crawl. The mere sight of this man, oh, yuck. Fucking hate him. Charlie, it's just absolutely terrible. And it's funny to look back on what could have been with this film as well. I guarantee you it's a much different beast without Dennis Hopper at the helm.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was originally basically going to be a feel-good family drama where it almost like a Disney film of sorts where,
PG-13.
Yeah, and it was going to, obviously Linda Marnes was still going to be the centerpiece of the film and still the alienation and the like, but she was going to see a psychiatrist and all was going to be well, happy ending. And then when Hopper took it over, he used one weekend to rewrite the entire film, and then the rest is history. I mean, and the film itself was actually continually... He was just each night he'd rewrite scenes, and apparently every single morning the crew would have to turn up to the trailer, this one specific trailer, meet up with Dennis. Dennis would come in with beers and cocaine for everyone. So yeah, Sharon Farrell, the his wife in the film, said that he was not just our director and writer, he was also our dealer.
He's a wild dude, man.
Just mind-blowing. So, yeah, every morning they'd be, getting off their chops, and then he would be saying, this is how this next scene's going to play out, and then they go and execute it. And it helps with a lot of these characters to, potentially be partially in that state.
Oh, for sure. And, look, there's nothing more transfixing to watch than a person on cocaine with a great idea. Because they fucking love telling the whole room about it. They get very animated. So I can just imagine every morning Dennis is like bringing in a couple of six packs of like fucking Budweiser and a bag of rack. And he's just like, guys, I've got this great idea for today. What we're going to do is we're going to do this. Oh, to be in that room.
Oh, yeah.
Nah. To be in that room. I probably would have died of a heart attack, but to be in that room. With the film, it starts off... I guess you'd call it a flashback of sorts, with CB being with her father, obviously Dennis Hopper, playing Don, in a semi-trailer, in a road train, cruising down the highway. Don's just chugging on a flat bottle of whiskey, as you do when you're driving tons of metal at 100 miles an hour down the highway. Danger is imminent because you see a broken down school bus across a couple of lanes of traffic. So I don't mean to chuckle. Don't mean to chuckle at all because it's fucked. But you can see where this is going. Drunken addict driving a semi-trailer, unfortunately with his daughter in the front seat with him, plows into a school bus, killing five or six children. Is that correct?
Mate, I'm not sure. I just assumed basically he nearly wiped the whole crew out. I actually can't remember the specific number.
Judging by the crash itself, they'd be lucky anyone getting out of that alive. So Don, this is basically where the movie starts, right? And Don serves a prison sentence. I think it's only about 5 years, which is fucking bullshit. Should never see the light of day again. Serves a 5-year prison sentence. And then we obviously pick up the story where we've got CB, who is, I don't like the term tomboy, but a rebellious teenager. And she is being, I use loosely, looked after by her heroin addicted mum. Don's still in jail, but she, unfortunately, and it's heartbreaking, she yearns for a connection with her father because her mother is so vacant and so distant. Even though he's an incredible piece of shit that risked her life, could have killed her, she still is craving attention, love from her father.
When it starts, and just for those that may not have seen it or is reflecting back on it, like she's in this particular scene, she's meant to be 8 years old and she's in a Halloween costume. I think she's a clown costume.
Yeah, dressed up as a clown, yeah.
And she's singing Elvis Presley over and over, Teddy Bear.
Babies, let me be your teddy bear. Put a chain around my neck. Be anywhere, sleep. Let me be your teddy bear. Put a chain around my neck and swing me anywhere.
The themes and the wording of music and lyrics through this entire film is so, you know, on point as well. You know, she's basically her dad's teddy bear. There's a moment in that scene where Don turns to CB and, you know, they're basically, like, you don't realize it at first. You just think it's this repartee between the father and daughter sort of in, you know, light banter and all the rest. And then, you know, he says, am I as sexy as Elvis, after she's singing Teddy Bear over and over. And she's gone, she says yes. And they exchange a kiss on the lips.
Am I as sexy as Elvis? What to ask?
Yeah. You could be if you
Wanted to.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Even then, like the first watch, I didn't take too much of it, but obviously, you know, his focus is more than just CB being his daughter. On top of the whiskey and all the rest of it, his focus when he takes out this busload of children is, you know, his focus is in a couple of places it shouldn't be, and it's not till later. And then now when I watch that opening scene, I feel sick to the hilt.
Oh, for sure. It's a when you first see the film, you go, that's a bit odd. That's a bit strange. I don't think I'd kiss from the lips, but, you know, as it goes on, everything does unveil itself. It's just the beginning too. And like you said, CB at this time is about 8 or 9 years old. And it shows that, and it continues throughout the film, bar one scene, and we'll get to that scene, I guess, the entire film, CB is seen as prey by men.
Agree.
She is cornered, harassed, and eventually abused by nearly every man in her life.
It's just a vile world that she is present in, and I think that's what Hopper's really trying to get across.
Absolutely. And the fact that it makes you feel that way, and it's so upfront and honest with how disgusting that world is I really respect Hopper's honesty in this. And I think it's a film that's very self-reflective. There's a lot of stories that have come out of Hollywood through those years, and not just Hollywood, but all types of the music scenes, various music scenes, whether it was punk, glam rock, pop. There's been predators and just vultures throughout all of those subcultures, right? And this is shining a light on that. It's just so sad that you've got this shining light in CB, someone who's got so much life and so much spirit, and constantly that light and that spirit is trying to be extinguished by vile, disgusting men and women as well. There are women through this that turn a blind eye, or I don't want to say encourage, but enable these disgusting men to do these things. It's a tough watch. And like you said, just after that scene, you start to see what CB's life is in Don's absence when he's in prison. CB's mum, Kathy, she has an affair with the guy that owns the cafe or the restaurant that Kathy works at. But the big problem is Don's friend, Charlie, the piece of shit that we spoke about before. He is the local drug dealer, and he basically is trying also to have an affair with Kathy, holding drugs over her as a bribe, I guess, or a currency. And at the same time, trying to have an affair with Kathy, but is also always leering and being lured towards CB.
Charlie is introduced basically while Don's in prison, and they're at the 10-pin bowling alley, and the scene, it's trying to give a broader scope of how all men at this time were similar to this. You know, that's what Dennis is trying to get across, and they're sitting there, and CB comes in with her two female teenage friends, and straight away Charlie's tells his mate, you know, just turn around real slowly, and it's basically they're just leering at these three girls, and that's when he goes over and he's stroking through CB's hair, and CB doesn't think anything of it because this is the world she lives in. Like you said at the beginning, such a piece of shit. He never veers away from that.
No, and like you said too, like the fact that CB doesn't think anything of that sexualization and those touches is, you don't realize it on first watch at the beginning, but then you start to begin to realize towards the end of the film or on a second watch that she doesn't realize that, because that's behavior that she's always had done to her from her own father. Oh man, it's a tough film. It is a brutal film. What CB, she kind of finds solace in, I guess, and escapes in, is music. She loves her punk rock. She loves Elvis Presley. And what she does very often, which has been immortalized in one of my favorite songs too, which I forgot all about, and you sent me a link, Hulsh, of the Primal Scream song, Kill All Hippies. I love the scene when CB goes to the direct semi-trailer, which is at their family property, which is a really stark and morbid reminder of what happened too. You know, you can never really move on when you've got a crushed semi-trailer that killed countless children in your backyard. But what CB will often do is the radio in that still works, and she quite often goes in there and talks to local truckers who are driving around, and she uses these, I wouldn't call them catchphrases or mantras, but just lyrics, I guess, from like punk songs.
Hello, this is Gorgeous. Anybody out there read me?
10-4, I read.
My handle's Gorgeous. Pretty vacant, eh? My dad's handle's Flash. Subvert normality. You know what that makes us together?
Yeah, fucking nuts.
Fuck you. Together, that makes us Flash Gorgeous.
Flash Gorgeous?
Punk is not sexual. It's just aggression. 10-4, old buddies. Destroy. Kill all hippies. I'm not talking at you. I'm talking to you.
That's 10-4.
Anarchy. Disco sucks. I don't want to hear about you. I want to hear from you. This is Gorgeous. Does anybody out there read me?
10-4, Gorgeous. We read you. Let's go dancing. How about disco? Over.
Disco sucks. Kill all hippies. Pretty vacant, eh? Subvert normality.
Sub what normalities? Gorgeous, you're just a crazy little kid. Tell me, what's this pretty vacant? Over.
What's your 1022?
Gaster Junction.
Signing off. This is Gorgeous signing off.
I'm going to assume here, like there's lyrics from the Sex Pistols and a few other punk bands. And obviously she's obsessed with punk bands and Elvis Presley. And from a 14-year-old, the way she's saying things about being pretty vacant and subvert normality and all these, you know that this is a young girl that is craving acceptance and is also craving escape. And she's almost parroting these lyrics or these, I guess, mantras from these bands and from this scene without fully understanding what it means, but it still makes sense. But it doesn't make sense to the truckers hearing it. Quite a few of them are like, what the fuck are you talking about? In between escaping to that and listening to punk rock music, she obviously has free rein because of a, like we said, a vacant parenting style of her junkie mother. So she goes around the local pub scene, I guess, and dive bar scene is Vancouver the city?
Yeah, Vancouver, correct.
And there's a couple of pivotal scenes in her little journeys that she does, and one is that she catches a cab, and I believe she's smoking weed, or she's smoking crack. I think it's weed.
I think it's weed, yeah.
Smoking weed. Crack probably hasn't really hit Vancouver by 1980. I should probably do my research. That's more south central LA in the early 80s. I need to freshen up on my drug history, Holsh. But she's smoking weed with, again, another predatory male, a cab driver who takes her home and basically, along with his, I think, stripper girlfriend or prostitute girlfriend, they make advances on her as well.
They get into a chat about punk music and, you know, do you like punk? And he's going, oh, yeah, I don't mind punk. And it's sort of this over, like, a man that you can tell doesn't look after himself, hair everywhere. And then he talks her into, oh, do you want to come back and listen to some punk, you know, at my place? Oh, yeah, that sounds good. And he takes her to a brothel.
Oh, that's right. Sorry, man. Yeah, that's right.
And then in one of the rooms has got the fucking seediest, scariest sex worker I've ever seen just standing there with her one foot up on a chair so you can see basically everything through this scantily. And she doesn't say a word and she's there just staring at CB. And CB's character, you know, while it's got all this repressed trauma and she's still very innocent. In this particular scene, she rolls into the fetal position and puts a thumb in her mouth, which she does throughout the film to show she's got this tough outside persona, but deep down inside, there's something that's really hurting. At this point, this is when old mate who said he's going to come back and listen to punk with her, he's playing the guitar and playing this absolute fucking shit folk music.
And, that's the 1980 version of going to a party and someone's like, oh man, I can play guitar. This is a little song called Wonderwall.
But anyway, he puts the guitar down and then this sex worker just comes over and it's like the exact same pose but puts a foot over the top of CB. So CB's looking straight up a schnatter and that's when she turns around with the bottle and smashes it over her head, over the guy's head to sort of get out of there. But it feels as grotty as any room in the world could possibly be.
Yeah, fucking terrifying scene, that one. You just feel the imminent danger. Like you said before about her talking on the CB radio to the truckers, it's like she's 14, which is young as fuck anyway, but she even looks and sounds younger than that. Mm. She looks like a child of 8 or 9 years old to be thrown in those situations. And the thing is, too, like you said, she is still so innocent, yet she has this bravado, and I guess it's a coping mechanism or a defense mechanism that she comes across so much older than what she actually looks and appears and is.
Totally.
Until there are times of great trauma. Like you said, she then goes into that kind of position of just fear and trauma again. Basically, she flees from that situation and comes across a punk concert. Mm. Now, I would probably have to say, Holsh, this is the only point in the film that has remnants or a smidge of joy in it.
It is.
Am I correct in saying so,
mate? For sure. This is one moment where I think Linda Mahan's acting is just unbelievable. And there's a bit of a cool story about this because there's a scene. Obviously, she's at the punk concert, and then she meets them behind the scenes, and then the drummer who she obviously become friendly with lets her have a fucking hit out on the drum set on stage. And when she walks off and goes to the side room where some of the groupies and that are standing, her face is like, it's the one time in the movie it's just absolute pure joy. But a really cool story with this. The band is called The Pointed Sticks, a Vancouver punk band, and this was a genuine concert. Everyone attending the concert were told, you're going to be on a movie tonight. You're going to be shot in a movie, Dennis Hopper movie. And Dennis Hopper was meant to land there at a certain time. 8 hours later, Dennis Hopper comes crashing through the door with all the camera crew and all the rest. He apparently did it on purpose, but he was also riddled with cocaine, and he wanted everyone to look, to a degree, absolutely fucked, knackered,
absolutely mangled,
and then obviously they all lifted, but he got the shots that he wanted because of this. So they say that, and I'm like, I just don't know whether that was pre-planned by Hopper or, you know, he just sort of got sidetracked. But yeah, that's the story.
My theory is a happy accident by Dennis. I believe if we're going to be judging on Dennis's history, I believe what's happened there is like, yeah, I'll be there at 7. Yeah. By 7 o'clock, he's absolutely onto his second bag of coke. He's fucking three quarters of a whiskey bottle down, and 6 hours later, he thinks, fuck, what was I meant to do? And then quickly gets to the club.
Yeah, nailed it.
No, exactly. That's, I'll put money on it. That's fucking happened. So yeah. Not long after this, and again, this was such a moment of joy in a film that doesn't have much, if any, at all. CB is found by police, and they basically process her, I guess, as a runaway.
Yeah.
Which means that she is then forced to or made to be evaluated by a court-appointed psychiatrist or psychologist who, in speaking with CB, starts to, I guess, understand and gather some things, would you say, Hulsh?
And Raymond Burr, who acts as the psychiatrist, he's the only Canadian actor on this film, even though it's a Canadian-produced film, and he was Perry Mason, I think, in the TV show.
No way.
Yeah, Perry Mason.
He was too.
But I think the key thing to take out of his very brief performance, he only has two short scenes, is he is literally the only adult in this entire movie that has morals. The only one.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, he's the only male in this entire shit show with any type of, yeah, like you said, morals or moral compass or understanding of what is right and wrong. Unfortunately, the film after this goes into what you would call a death spiral with the release of Dennis Hopper being released from prison on probation after spending fucking far too less, not enough, years in prison for killing a entire busload of school children. He returns home, I wouldn't say to a hero's welcome, but Kathy's trying to get the family back together through her heroin-addled haze. Go straight away from Donna's. He does not fucking feel remorse at all. And in a scene that just makes me so fucking angry, they're at the celebration of him being home, and instead of showing any type of remorse or self-awareness at all, he's straight back on the bottle getting absolutely fucking hammered drunk, and he is confronted by the father of one of the kids killed in that accident. And he basically just stands up and tells the bloke, fucking so what, get over it.
You know my daughter?
Yeah.
Go to school, my daughter?
Yeah.
Ride the bus?
Yeah.
Did you know my son? Did you know my son? Ride the bus with my son. Remember my son?
Okay, all right. You know, so you can't see this.
Freak.
I'm a motherfucking asshole, you know that? I did 5 fucking years, you know? In prison. And there were a lot of other kids in there besides your son. Now, am I gonna have to meet every fucking asshole like you, man? Look, I'm an asshole. You see this? You see me? You see that? But I'm not a motherfucking dumb asshole. Because there's enough here for 2 drinks. Now you sit down. You sit down and have a drink. Come on. Give him a glass, man. Give him a dirty glass. Here, come on. I'm sorry about your son, but I didn't have nothing to do with it, baby.
Hey, motherfucker.
That scene, as a father, I mean, it hit me. I saw this film for the first time before I became a father, and I saw this film. I should tell listeners too, the last time I saw Out of the Blue is a couple of years ago, so I'm working off memory. You've had a much more recent watch of this. You've watched it a couple of times in the last few weeks, in fact. But since becoming a father, this movie hits 100 times harder.
For sure.
Wouldn't you say?
For sure. And you're putting yourself in the footsteps of this bloke. It's unfortunate he looks as seedy as anyone else in the film. But if your child was taken from you and this bloke's just walked back into town and could not give a shit, and the way that he does deal with him in conversation to basically just sort of shrug it off and just say, you know, have a drink with me. It's, you know, what's done is done. Like, that would make it 100 times worse.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. It's probably the first time in the movie you really understand Don's character, because the bus scene and the scene where they meet him at the jail, like, you can't really tell what a vile rank person he is until this first scene with this father of the lost child.
Yeah, this scene gets me so worked up as a dad. But you know what? It makes me feel as though I'm a great dad in comparison. And we live in Australia, obviously, and last weekend was the Australian Father's Day. And I tell you what, Holsh, the coolest dad ever socks that I receive from my kids is on the mark. Because if I compare myself to fucking Dennis Hopper in this movie, I am the coolest dad ever.
You are, mate. Well done.
Thank you. I'm pretty proud of myself by comparison. Yeah, so Don's just doesn't give a fuck. No remorse. Continues on. He gets a job working at the local dump, or what they call them in the US. Is it landfill?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, landfill, I think. You're right.
Landfill. Working at the local dump, which is about as good a job as you can hope for, because he's a fucking dump of a human. I believe, is it the same father? Yes. I think the same father, out of retaliation, gets him sacked from that job. Is that right?
Yeah, this is my favorite scene in the entire film.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So he's in the truck.
And he's fucking drinking while doing that too.
It's exactly, I was about to say, he's got the whiskey bottle the whole time. To be fair, he's got a job. Like, so he, you know, he at this point in time, he is able to provide to some degree. The dad that we just spoke about comes on and tells the boss, you know, you got to piss this bloke off because he is the guy that killed all our kids and all the rest of it. Get rid of him. This whole scene has no dialogue to it. So old mate, that's the boss, he's just given the big thumb, you know, piss off, you're out of here. And Don just vacantly looks back at him and he's like, well, I'm going to have the last say here. And he just gets this fucking beast of a machine and rolls it over their smoko hut, or, you know, whatever his little office that they have on the dump site, and just crushes it. And he's just like back and forth, just absolutely pulverizes it. Slowly gets down out of it, has another swig, sort of just glances over at old mate and then walks off. The way it's shot, the no dialogue, but everything that he's trying to represent and get across is nailed 100%. But if you finish a job and you hate your boss and, you know, you've got that wonderful feeling, you can say, you know, I've quit, fuck you. You know, it's a wonderful thing in the moment, but it's also the moment where a lot of other things come crashing down. You burnt that bridge. You're never going to get another job after you've done something like this to an employer. And I think it really signifies the absolute crash of his life, because everything from this scene onwards is fucked up completely. And this is when you start feeling a little bit sicker every scene till the very end.
Yeah, I mean, his life was already a fucking dumpster fire to begin with, and this is just pouring more gasoline on top of that. And I tell you what, there's been quite a few jobs I've wanted to fucking roll over with a bulldozer myself after leaving, but thankfully I've had enough common sense to not do so as much as I've wanted to. But like you said, this is the tipping point in the entire film, a pivotal point where things just tip over, because after this, Don, with the help of Charlie, basically go, well, fuck this dude. Even though he is, the worst thing he's done to me is made me lose my job. The worst thing I've done to him is kill his child. Let's make it even worse and let's go over and beat the shit out of this guy.
I think they murder him, don't they?
Do they?
Oh, I think he's got like a razor or like, you know, like a flick knife. And he smashes it. Oh, he does too.
See, I haven't seen it for a while. I forgot about that part.
Yeah, it's pretty fucking horrid. I think one of them confronts him from one side and then the other just like starts whooping it into the back of his neck.
That's right.
In a car park and just leaves his body laying there in the blood. They come in, they're prepared, they've got their gloves on and the like, and then they just slowly walk off and leave him there.
Fucking premeditated murder. Let's put that on with vehicular manslaughter of children and historical sexual abuse of your own daughter. This guy's got quite the rap sheet. After this, I believe, it goes to a scene where Don is showing CB some things that he's found at the dump site before getting sacked and destroying the place. And he shows her some dynamite, which is pivotal. A precursor.
Because yeah. Even in these scenes, these initial scenes after Don is out of jail between him and CB, it seems like genuine love between the two of them. Even though... Like, that's where this innocence comes back into play, and the fact that CB needs some sort of role model or some sort of idol to look up to, because all her idols aren't real anymore. Like, Elvis is dead, and I think the Sex Pistols, Johnny Rotten had passed away by this stage.
Yeah, so, they were a flash in the pan. They were out for, like, they just shone brightly and burnt out quickly. And that's it, like you said, mate. Everything that she loves and admires has already been and gone, and she's craving someone to love and to look up to.
Yeah, she's just clinging on to this dad as the idol, and it sort of comes to fruition that innocence slowly does deteriorate to the point a bit later on where she realizes this isn't how it's meant to be as a father figure.
Yeah, I don't want to say much about the absolute final conclusion of this film. Would you agree, Holsch?
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
We'll take listeners on a journey up until a point. The ending is a gut punch. It's not a twist ending. It's nothing like that, but I don't want to give away exactly what happens in the final scene. Would you agree?
Yeah, I'm okay with that.
Well, I think we go to a point because it's a film I don't want to completely ruin or dampen the impact of. There's quite a cathartic release to the ending of this film. It's devastating, but it's still something that I would prefer people to experience fresh or with fresh eyes. There's another scene not long after this, Holsch, where, again, the adults in the room are all disgusting and they're all drunk. CB's mum, Kathy, is high on heroin. Charlie and Don are at first joking, but then it turns very serious about CB's sexuality. I think they keep saying that she's lesbian, homosexual, and then they start saying some really disgusting shit.
This is the scene that every time I reflect on it, I feel physically ill. Just the way that they carry themselves in this manner.
With good reason. This is one of the most distressing scenes I can recall in nearly any film. I find this film more viscerally disturbing than a lot of hardcore gore scenes in horror movies. Easily. This is one of the most confronting scenes.
Oh, for sure. And it's both her father, her father's best friend, and the mother. All three are as low life folk as you could ever imagine.
Sorry. And the heartbreaking thing is too, Holsch, this is, like you said, it's an honest portrayal of low-income, poverty-line families in a lot of different cultures. Not only in the US, this kind of stuff, and stuff happens in, you know, Australia as well. And you read about it unfortunately, you hear about it happening both locally and on the news and things like that. Such a disturbing thing, but it's the honesty and the gravity of this is, they don't shy away from it in the film.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably a big reason why it hasn't been watched by enough people because of the topic and the genre. But full kudos to Hopper for, you know, actually making a movie about these marginalized folk and, you know, in an isolated town. This is how they get by.
Yeah, this is exactly, this is a reality for these people. As fucked up and as distressing as it is, this is a reality for a lot of people in these type of families and these type of arrangements. It's devastating, but it's actually shining a light on it. And like we said prior, both you and I mentioned it, this is basically a curtain call on that nihilistic attitude that began in the late 60s. There's got to be a tipping point. right? There's got to be a point in time when if you're a ride or die fucking counterculture anti-establishment nihilist, this is the fallout that happens. This is the effect it has on people. This is what happens to your family if you happen to have one. It's an old burnt out drug using piece of shit. And this is what happens when you don't care about anybody but yourself. So basically, yeah, Don has a discussion with Charlie about potentially assaulting and allowing an assault to happen to CB. She is in her room at the time, and Don and Charlie try to get into her room. And at the time of her being in her room, I believe, I'll refresh me if I'm fuzzy on the details, this is where she is dressed in a leather jacket and trying to do her hair like Elvis.
Yeah, and drawing on her own sideburns. She's got her dad's biker hat on. And
she's trying to be the male presence or the father figure herself, maybe.
Oh, yeah.
She's trying to show a representation of what she wishes her father was, or just, you know what I mean? Like she's hasn't had a male presence to look up to ever.
Yeah.
And they've all been predators, all been pieces of shit. I just think maybe she just thought that she would escape inward into herself and create one herself.
Yeah.
That's how I've always read that.
Yeah, that makes sense. The whole lead up for her doing that is she can hear everything that they're saying out at the table, and it's a real...
Which is fucking horrifying.
It is. And Dennis Hopper's sort of going off on this crazy ranting tangent the whole time and, you know, talking to... And during that, and he just doesn't stop. And during that time, Charlie takes Kathy into the lounge room and just starts groping her breasts and her nether regions and that, and basically just having his way with his wife while Don just continues to rave on and on and on. And then they come back in, and that's when Kathy, the mum, starts screaming out, "I don't want her to be a dyke. I don't want her to be a dyke." This whole time, CB's in a room listening to it, and obviously that's what's triggered this sort of transformation that she's doing.
It's powerful and disturbing stuff. When both men enter CB's room, she manages to tell them to get the fuck out, essentially.
With a chair.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that part. Yeah. Unfortunately, it may cause Charlie to get out permanently, but Don, yeah, returns later to CB's bedroom and in a state of absolute, he's just fucked up. And I think he's trying to kind of kid himself or trying to almost gaslight CB into thinking that, you know, remember when we did this when we were kids and we did that, I'm such a good dad, and, you know, all these happy, fond memories. And instead she basically just says, no, I remember everything you've fucking done to me and everything you've put me through. Really powerful scene, this one, Holsh, and obviously ends quite, I've got to say, that with this scene, I gave a little bit of a fist pump.
Oh, Linda Marnes again, like her acting prowess in this scene, especially, like, you can tell, like, a switch has changed for her in this whole lead up to this scene, and her mindset towards her dad is very different. The way she uses her body for what is a 14-year-old girl, basically it starts seducing her own dad to put him in the position that in the end is his demise. It's fucking... Well,
she uses it to disarm him. She sexualizes herself to disarm him, basically, and because she's just been hearing through the walls that the vile sexualization of her as well. And this is a man that she waited 5 or 6 years to get out of prison. Mm. Like he committed this horrible fucking crime of killing all these people while drunk when she was 8 or 9 years old, still a young child, had the hope that he would come out of prison a changed man, a better man, comes out the same, if not worse. And like you said it perfectly, something's been flicked. A switch has been flicked. She realizes now there's only one option. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, she's just going to be passed around and used by vultures if she doesn't do something about it right now. And like you said, the use of her body in this scene to disarm and seduce her own father to a point where he is defenseless. You can give the audience the method of disposal, if you like, Holsh.
Yeah. So during this disarming and Hopper's sort of creeping in closer to her sort of lower genitalia region, you can see her like fumbling behind her, trying to grab a few different things from underneath a pillow. And the first thing she grabs is a pair of used black panties of hers and stuffs them into Don's mouth, which is really powerful in the way that she does it. And because of the state Don's in, he just accepts it and takes this as an obliging daughter, and things are all going well. But then the scissors come out from behind in the other hand and just starts pounding it into his chest and neck. He rolls back and you see the blood just, what do you call it? Squibs?
Squibs.
The squibs. I always wanted to use that word on our podcast. I've always admired when you've used the word squibs. So it is as he's fallen backwards, the blood's just like spurting across the room. There's no remorse on her face whatsoever as well as this happens. I think something else that we should mention about that scene is that's the scene that confirms that she had abuse and violation to him going into prison. Like, up until this point, there hasn't been anything to say yay or nay. It helps us reflect on some of that first scene in the truck.
And that's exactly right. The context then, and upon reflection and watching it a second time, you pick up all of that then. It seems odd at first, but then it just makes, obviously it all starts to fall into place on what a despicable piece of shit he is.
Can I just say, I had no idea that was going to happen. And when it did happen, I was sitting here, full theater mode, pitch dark. And literally my guts dropped. Like, I felt so sick and everything in the movie just started flooding through my head. And I'm like, holy shit, this is guy. Like, I knew he was a scumbag, but I didn't know it was that bad. Completely until that very scene. And now it's, I can't talk anymore about it, but it's so hard. I've been a little bit desensitized from some of the films, but nothing can desensitize you from this film.
No, this is one of the all-time feel-bad classics. You will leave this film feeling bad, but you'll also leave it feeling as though you've seen what I consider at least a masterpiece, at the very least, a great movie, a great film. You might not have a great feeling after leaving it, though. I also have to say too, Holt, that as we all know, I am a goat farmer. I collect goats. By goats, I mean greatest of all time performances or crew, directors, actors, screenwriters, cinematographers. We're adding a goat again this week. I gotta add Linda Marnes. She's got to be there.
Oh, agree. I actually had noted down to ask you, I said, is this the greatest of all time 18-year-old performance, even though she is acting as a 14-year-old? I've never felt an actress at that age feel so real.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think in this journey so far, we've had going through all the films of 1980, and I know you've been on such a massive binge, and your research and respect of film has reached just incredible peaks because you've watched how many films from 1980?
I think I'm up to 38.
Films. 38 films just from 1980. That is remarkable. So you've done thorough research. I haven't been to that extent. I've tried to rewatch everything, obviously, a couple of times that we are focusing on in this countdown and a few other exterior ones that just missed out from 1980. But I'm pretty confident in saying the two best performances from 1980, for me personally, and it's been remarkable rewatching them, are from two female performers that are put into just diabolical situations for their role. And that was Teresa Russell from Bad Timing. I raved about her, and she achieved GOAT status for me purely on Bad Timing, and I'm doing the same for Linda Marnes in this performance. If ever there's a singular performance that deserves to be called GOAT, it's this one. Linda Marnes is just incredible. And this, and you touched on it, that flicking of the switch in this scene just guarantees this is one of the, not only just the great child performances, even though she was herself 18 or 19 when the film was made, she's playing a 14-year-old. Not only just one of the great child performances, just one of the great performances, period, for me.
Mm. No, I agree, mate. I think it's a phenomenal, phenomenal acting.
So Dennis slash Don has just copped multiple scissors to the chest and neck and is bleeding out, and fuck yeah, deservedly so. There is something that happens post this scene, and this is what we're kind of alluding to earlier. I'm happy to leave it out. Yep. I'm happy to leave it out from this. I want people to experience it for the first time.
Okay. Yep.
If you're cool with that. So in lieu of that, we've basically gotten now to the end of essentially what the plot was. Let's talk about the film itself, Holsh. Visually, I love it because it doesn't shy away from the grit and grime of these people and their situations. I think the city, the cityscapes and the scenes of CB exploring the city by herself are some of my favorite scenes, not only in the film itself, but in film in general.
The way they shoot it is, once again, it definitely puts you in the presence of CB's life, and even some of the shots amongst the bars when Don and Charlie and so forth, how they pivot the camera so it's more or less using their male gaze.
The camera does leer, and you notice it more a second time through. Once you understand what has been going on, and once you've got the context of how despicable Don and Charlie and all these guys are, and not only those guys, every man that Linda Munns or CB interacts with through the entire film is leering at her, is seeing her as prey. A lot of the shots in this film reflect that. I just think it's for such a brutal film and a grimy film, it is shot so perfectly for that type of feeling and type of emotion and theme that they're going for. Soundtrack, incredible, obviously.
Unbelievable.
We've got some classic needle drops in this. You want to talk us through some of those?
You got your Elvis, your Neil Young sort of prominent through the whole thing, and then you got some punk as well. But just the way that he uses it, the theme song, which is called Out of the Blue, well, it's in brackets, I think. I think it's like Hey Hey My My and in brackets Out of the Blue by Neil Young. It's a real mournful, harrowing track, and it's got a line in it. It's better to burn out than to fade away, which, without giving too much away, it sort of hits the nail on the head for this movie and the way that CB is thinking. So Elvis, once again, Heartbreak Hotel and Teddy Bear are the two.
It's so lonely, baby. Well, it's so lonely. It'll be so lonely they could die.
I don't know. It feels like all of them are making a statement in themselves that if the acting wasn't already fucking hitting you across the head, then the music sort of is just the reaffirming of it.
Absolutely. What I find really funny too is, Holsh, the contradiction in, I guess, the style between Elvis and punk rock, right? So Elvis, some people have said, was punk rock in a way that he was so controversial upon starting his career with his hip thrusts and heavily borrowing a lot of black culture with his music. But to be fair, Elvis was a mainstream artist. He sang a lot of other people's works. He you know, wrote some of his songs, sung covers of others. He was pushed predominantly in the mainstream. The fact that CB idolizes him, and then on the flip side, idolizes true punk rock, is a funny little contradiction, and that shows also her innocence and her vulnerability. And there's a contradiction between a mainstream artist and a punk rock artist. I'm sure there's a lot of punk musicians that looked up to Elvis and idolized him, and a lot have been on record as they have. And there's been a lot that have come out and said that Elvis was just a puppet for the mainstream as well. But her equal love for both punk rock and Elvis, I guess, shows that young innocence and vulnerability and being naive as well, I guess, to a lot of it as well. I think that contradiction is really important as well. It just shows CB's mindset, I guess. I think that she looks at Elvis and how he's presented with the leather jacket and the hair, and like we said too, that her transformation into him when both those predators enter her room towards the end also just shows that she's just sinking into a make-believe, into a different identity to escape her reality.
Yeah, I think that's a really great breakdown. It's sort of, it's almost like Elvis is a pre-abuse and violation figure, and then the punk is the figure, you know, the Sex Pistols and all the rest of it come in as sort of a bit of that innocence has been sort of chipped away at, I guess. But
that's a perfect way of putting it. Yeah, actually, yeah, she's grown up on Elvis and then has now adopted the punk rock mindset. that innocence has gone, and it's been replaced with that, I guess, survival instinct and that hardening of mindset where she's just got to survive this. So the music is a very important part of this film. And it's safe to say that this is one of the, I guess, first punk rock kind of movies. And we touched on it earlier too, Holsch, with Hopper. This is definitely his most narratively straightforward film.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. It's definitely more narratively straightforward than those first two we spoke of.
Oh, like I would say that Easy Rider, to describe Easy Rider would be relatively plotless to a degree. I guess it's something that's a precursor to a lot of what's now called slow cinema in some respects as well. There are some films these days that in the slow cinema scene do meander along and do purposely have a lot of static shots and things like that. So I guess that was a ground zero for a lot of that type of filmmaking. But the last movie by Hopper is, like we said earlier, just an absolute clusterfuck of ideas. In comparison, Out of the Blue is a lot more straightforward. Again, a really tough watch, but one that I encourage everybody to sit down with. And through the course of this project that we're doing, Holsch, obviously rewatching these and not only just rewatching them, but doing a little bit of research that I hadn't done before and thinking a little bit deeper about certain things has made me, I guess, tinker internally with the ranking of these films. I'm pretty happy with where Out of the Blue sits, if I'm being fair. Yeah. I don't know if I would drop this at all. I know the big mover in these rewatches for me personally was Bad Timing. I had that listed at 8th. I think it would be up closer to 2 or 3. I don't see how I could drop this film any further. It's, again, it's one of those hard ones where it's a difficult watch. It's, the subject matter is just brutal, but it's such an incredible film that I cannot discount its power.
Yeah, look, it's a masterpiece, full stop. But when I finished watching the first time, I was like, there's no fucking way this makes my top 30. But
yep,
a day later, another day later, all I'm thinking about is this movie. And yeah, this has happened with every movie so far, almost, where I now, like literally 4 days later, I said to my wife, I can't stop thinking about this movie. That's what great movies do. Once again, context, we talk about it all the time, but if you don't understand a movie, it's obviously never going to make one of your, you know, favorites or one of your most respected movies ever. And for me, this movie would be highly respected now because it is immaculately made by a cocaine-driven maniac. But it is like we said before, like these sort of marginalized folk don't. There's no movies out there that really sort of show it and expose it to its full entirety. And this, the way he does it, and the way that my mind can't sway from it. Even I've watched other films since it, two or three films, and I can't even remember them. Whereas everything is so vivid from this film in my mind and my stomach and heart, that shows how impressive it really is.
Yeah, it's a powerful film, mate. And like I said, this is the one film so far in our project. Due to a career change, I haven't had a chance, time, to sit down and rewatch this recently. The last time I saw this was 2 years ago, but it is such a vivid film, such a vivid film experience. And the thing is, too, the subject matter in this obviously is traumatic. It's not an approval of these people's lifestyles.
Oh, no.
It's damning them. It is critiquing the end of that nihilistic selfish culture, and it's an absolute takedown of that. But it's just a film that, like you said, it just gets stuck in your head, and never has a film been so harrowing that I've wanted to watch over and over again as something like this. Obviously, trigger warnings, if you yourself have suffered any type of abuse that would be depicted in this film, I would probably recommend stay clear, because it's so realistic, this film. If you are able to watch this, by all means, do so. I just cannot recommend this film enough.
Look, I completely understand why it's where it is in your countdown, and I think the fact that you're showcasing it and putting a focus out there for people to reach out and see it, because it was basically not on the face of the planet for about 20 years. Very similar to Bad Timing. It essentially didn't have, people couldn't access it to watch it. And now, I forget, what was the name of that actress's name that you said that sort of...
Oh, I'm trying to think who it was. Chloe Sevigny?
Yeah.
Sevigny?
Yeah, so I watched some interviews about from the team that sort of pulled this new 4K together, because, you know, no one was seeing this film, and everyone out there... Jack Nicholson states that this is one of the greatest films ever made, and he said... It's an absolute crime, you know, it's a crime that people aren't seeing this film, because it's as good as it gets. And so this podcast, you know, if this gets some more people out there to at least feel what emotions this film can expose in yourself.
That's a good point. I didn't even think about the parallel there between this and Bad Timing being, you know, basically lost or only available on VHS for any number of years. I didn't even realize that parallel. And I didn't realize that Jack Nicholson was such a fanboy for it. That's fucking cool. That's it from me. I think I'm pretty done covering Out of the Blue, an exhausting yet rewarding watch. So this is this is number three. We've reached the podium, like I said.
Bronze medal.
The bronze medal film for 1980, Out of the Blue. What will come in at number two? Let me tell you, dear listener, it's maybe a film you're not expecting. I'm throwing a curveball at number two. Wouldn't you say, Holsch?
I will confirm you're not expecting this next one, but it is well-deserved.
Speaking of lost films, that's all I'm going to say. So number two will be one that I don't think a lot of listeners may – a lot of listeners that we have, and a lot of people that have reached out to me and said they've listened to the podcast are in a certain space on film Twitter. They probably have seen the number two film, but a lot of my friends out there that are listening who have reached out, I would safely bet that you may not have seen it. So tune in. Hopefully it's only a week or so away. Like I said, I've started a new job and career, which is taking up a lot of time. We will endeavour to try and get this out again next week. When we do, that will be the number two, the silver medalist for 1980. Thanks again, Holsch. It's been a pleasure talking to you, mate.
And love it. Just can't wait for every week to roll around. Loving it, mate.
It's getting down to the nitty-gritty. Top two, number two next week. Thanks again. Shameless plug time. You can find Lifetime Cinema Club on Instagram, on Twitter, refuse to call it X. You can find us on Twitter. Reach out, send us a message. There's a few followers there now. We're getting a few messages, people saying, thank you for covering that film. Hadn't seen that film. What the fuck are you talking about? We had a few of those different type of messages, and that's cool. That's cool. We just enjoy the interaction. From all of us at Lifetime Cinema Club HQ, thank you for joining us this week, and we will talk to you next week.